The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 28/April 4, 2022. As usual, the border of the front cover is in red with an inner, very narrow, white-edged border. Time is in large block print in gray, superimposed upon a dark green background, that being a forest as a backdrop in this photo, which is actually a portrait of three people. A young man in camouflage gear with a weapon slung across his shoulders and lying atop the front of him. He has both a backpack and a side pack, and the side pack features a greenish camouflage cross. I don't know what that implies. There's a young woman standing next to him. They appear to be striding along a rather rubbled-looking, either concrete, destroyed concrete, or sandy or gravelly terrain. There is a banister of sorts, an obstacle edging that roadway. It appears to be in concrete. The woman looks bereft. She has a grimace on her face that seems more sad than angry. She's has brown hair. She's dressed in either a dark blue or dark gray or black parka zipped up to her neck. She's in profile, as is the young man, who is the soldier. And on the woman's left earlobe is a sparkling gem. Then the soldier is holding in both arms a bundle of bright orange, which appears to be a baby, a small child. One sees his white chenille-looking, or her white chenille-looking booties poking out from this snowsuit garb. There appears to be a little cap on the child, and we do not see the child's face, just this big orange blob being carefully handled by the young man in uniform. To the text now, beginning with the view, Time to Act on Inflation by Lawrence H. Summers. During the 1960s and 70s, it took a dozen years for a toxic cocktail of excessive fiscal stimulus, misguided monetary policy focused on symptoms rather than causes, and bad luck on the supply side to generate stagflation, a mix of high inflation and a stagnant economy to develop. Stagflation and political dysfunction corroded trust in government and brought down the presidencies of Ford and Carter. History has sped up over time, and in a little more than a year, policy errors like those of the 1960s and 70s, along with bad luck, have brought the U.S. to the brink of stagflation. Income support payments to households and businesses in 2021 far exceeded any reasonable estimate of income reductions that resulted from COVID-19. The Federal Reserve, in ways reminiscent of the 1970s, proclaimed inflation was transitory and isolated to a few sectors, even as labor shortage became unprecedentedly severe and pervasive. Now the Ukraine crisis is leading to huge increases in food and energy prices. It is now likely inflation will continue to accelerate for at least several more months as commodity price hikes work through the system. Then it may recede, but not in all likelihood anywhere near the Fed's 2% target. With inflation now running above 7%, it is not surprising almost three times as many Americans think the country's on the wrong track as they think it on the right track. Small businesses are more likely to cite inflation as their principal worry than at any time since the beginning of President Reagan's disinflation in the 1980s. The dollar store has become the $1.25 store as consumers and customers are seeing the worst decline in decades in the purchasing power of their wages. Unfortunately, there are no easy and painless ways of ensuring the economy enjoys a soft landing. It was delusional, even before recent food and oil price explosions, to believe, given labor shortages and wages accelerating, that inflation would melt away. Hope is not a strategy. While there are certainly areas where enhanced antitrust action is warranted, scapegoating corporate greed for inflation is preposterous in the view of almost all serious economists. If there's a clear lesson from the 1970s, it is that Nixon's price controls were a disaster that exacerbated the build-up in inflation by reducing the pressure for monetary restriction. The urgent prerequisite for success in achieving a soft landing is a clear recognition by both the Biden administration and the Fed that the economy's current level of demand is unsustainable and has been for some time. We now need not to celebrate our sugar high, but to diet. The more we allow current excesses in both financial markets and the real economy to build up, the more painful the ultimate adjustment will be. I welcome the Fed's moves to phase out quantitative easing and raise interest rates, but they are insufficient. The Fed has not explained how, with hundreds of economists on the staff and almost every employer in the country reporting cost increases they were passing on, it managed to underestimate 2021 inflation by a factor of 3. Without such an explanation, it's hard to be confident that they now have things under control. Nor has the Fed signaled an intention to abandon the operating framework that brought us to this point by ruling out monetary tightening till it was completely clear the economy was overheating. The Fed's the most important actor with respect to inflation, but administration policy's crucial too. Unfortunately, the administration often emphasizes ideas that are good on the merits, but will have negligible effects on inflation for years, like beginning antitrust actions in a few industries or building new infrastructure. Worse, it advances ideas that in terms of inflation are counterproductive, like Buy America policies that mandate shifts from lower to higher cost suppliers. As another example, if the Keystone Pipeline had not been rejected, it's probable it would be providing more oil than will be lost to the embargo. A more constructive agenda would focus on cost reduction for the benefit of consumers by letting market forces work. Retiring Justice Stephen Breyer's main contribution to U.S. policy was his work with Senator Edward Kennedy to deregulate airlines. Why not reduce shipping costs by repealing the obsolete Jones Act? At a time when housing costs are soaring, why not eliminate restrictions on lumber imports from Canada? More broadly, tariff reductions directly operate to reduce prices for consumers and to make exporters more competitive by holding down their input costs. Some policy problems are intractable, not inflation. We know what must be done to reduce it. It is time to act. The author of that article, Lawrence H. Summers, is a professor at and former president of Harvard University, and was U.S. Treasury Secretary from 1999 to 2001. Will China try to stop Russia? This is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. European and U.S. diplomats have worked hard to win help from China, a country powerful enough and close enough to Russia, they hope, to change Vladimir Putin's plans. March 8, China's President Xi Jinping held a video call with France's Emmanuel Macron and Germany's Olaf Scholz to talk about the war, fueling hopes Xi would become more actively involved in brokering a deal to end the fighting. We should not get our hopes up. There is no doubt Russia's war is bad for Beijing. China imports more oil than any other country on earth, and the conflict in Ukraine has pushed prices to their highest levels since 2008. China needs energy, metals, and minerals to fuel its economy, and agricultural products to feed its people. All these commodities have become much more expensive for China and everyone else. President Xi also acknowledged recently Western sanctions will affect global finance, energy, transportation, and the stability of supply chains, and dampen the global economy that's already ravaged by the pandemic. By publicly blaming sanctions for the upheaval, he is careful not to hold Putin accountable. The invasion's also damaging China's international reputation. Xi understands many Europeans and Americans are ready to tag China as Russia's accomplice. On the eve of the Winter Olympic Games in China, Putin and Xi met and made a big show of their emerging friendship, which their joint statement claimed had no limits. 2 weeks later, Russia invaded Ukraine. Finally, Russia's war in Ukraine has also shifted geopolitics to China's disadvantage. In recent years, the emerging giant has benefited greatly from disagreements between Europeans and Americans about what sort of world they want to build and how best to protect it. 3 decades after the Cold War's end, many in the West, including the previous U.S. president, have questioned NATO's purpose and value. That has lessened the risk for China that Western leaders might expand NATO's mission into Asia or work with China's Asian rivals to build a NATO knockoff. The war in Ukraine has instantly created unity between Europe and America and given NATO a clearer purpose. In all these ways, a quick end to Russia's war would be very good for China. But China's motives are mixed. While Putin has worked tirelessly in recent years to destabilize Russia's less cooperative neighbors and to redraw post-Cold War boundaries, the international status quo has worked very much to China's advantage. China's future depends on decent relations with the West. Unlike Russia, China has benefited mightily from relative global stability and positive commercial relations with Europe and America. Xi also knows Russia's a much less valuable commercial partner. In 2021, China's trade with Russia topped out at $147 billion. Compare that with $756 billion with the U.S. and $828 billion with the EU. U.S. and European companies have also served as a source of invaluable investment and have provided access to vitally important new technologies that China still needs. Yet China's supreme leader also has good reason to build a friendship with Putin. A sharp turnover the past decade in Washington's attitude toward China has convinced many in Beijing that America's determined to stunt China's growth. In addition, China could use a like-minded and powerful friend. For years, its only true ally has been North Korea. Russia's a much more valuable sidekick. More to the point, Xi and Putin share a common grand ambition to end American hegemony. China's mixed motives have been apparent in Beijing's choices since the war started. Russian officials said earlier this week China has refused to supply Russian airlines with key parts that America's Boeing and Europe's Airbus will no longer provide. But state-dominated media coverage in China has been overtly pro-Russian, and China's foreign ministry has publicly backed Russia's false claims that the U.S. is supporting an illegal bioweapons program inside Ukraine. For now, China will say soothing things about how cooler heads must prevail to stop the war in Ukraine and the West's economic assault on Russia. Xi will try to undermine European suspicions of his Russian sympathies by agreeing with them on the importance of diplomacy. But while he sees America and Europe as commercial partners of necessity, in Putin he sees a true fellow traveler. How Putin is beating the West at deterrence, by John Bolton, who was the National Security Advisor in 2018-2019 for President Donald Trump. Deterrence is working in the Ukraine crisis, just not for the right side. In this tragedy's most catastrophic blunder, the U.S. and its allies failed to deter Russia from invading. President Joe Biden's plan to create deterrence relied almost exclusively on threats that would be executed only after Russian forces crossed Ukraine's borders. Unfortunately, the West's credibility in threatening after-the-fact punishments was shredded by its earlier failures to impose stringent sanctions following the Kremlin's assaults on Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014. Even beyond this yawning credibility gap, Biden's total deterrence package was palpably inadequate. Most seriously, he said in early December 2021, and repeatedly thereafter, U.S. military force was off the table. This was an unforced, unilateral concession, with no Russian reciprocity sought or given. Biden could simply have said nothing, hiding his intentions, and let the ambiguity weigh on Putin's mind. Instead, he gave Putin a freebie. That was not all. No effort was made to inflict harm on Russia pre-invasion. Had appreciable costs been imposed before Moscow's forces crossed an international border, damages felt in real time, they might have changed Putin's cost-benefit calculus. For example, there was no push to halt the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, let alone economically cripple Russia's broader energy sector, unless and until all Russian forces were withdrawn from European countries, which did not consent to their presence, not just Ukraine, but also Moldova, Georgia, and others. Russian financial assets, including those of prominent oligarchs, could have been seized or frozen till Russia's military buildup on Ukraine's borders was reversed and the troops returned to their regular barracks. Sanctions work best when they're massive, swift, and ruthlessly implemented. In the Ukraine case, that did not happen before or after Russia invaded. America and NATO could have deployed more forces to Ukraine to train and assist Ukraine's military. Considerably more weapons and ammunition could have been shipped to Ukraine at a far more accelerated pace than was actually undertaken. None of this happened. Instead, counterproductively, White House officials spoke frequently about imposing negative consequences for further invasion of Ukraine, thinking themselves quite clever in not ignoring the 2014 attack. Ironically, however, their rhetorical flourish did just that, revealing critical deficiencies in their thinking and confirming to Putin there was no risk Russia's actions in 2014 would be reversed. Opponents of raising Russia's pre-invasion costs said so doing would actually provoke a Russian attack, as if that is not exactly what happened anyway. Western deterrence failed, but now Russian deterrence is enjoying, unfortunately, spectacular success. Building on Biden's earlier voluntary rejection of U.S. military involvement, Russia's convinced the West that even a whisper of NATO military action in Ukraine would bring disastrous consequences. Putin's directive enhancing the alert status of Russia's nuclear forces brought on something approaching panic in the West. Although there's no publicly available evidence, Russia's forces have operationally changed anything. Desperate Ukrainian requests for a NATO no-fly zone over Ukraine have been flatly rejected by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who said the only thing worse than a war that's contained to Ukraine is one that escalates even further and goes beyond it. This logic is false, a classic non sequitur. It rests on the tacit but manifestly incorrect premise that even one hostile encounter between Russian and Western forces will escalate immediately to all-out, possibly nuclear war. Obviously, there are risks in any NATO military role, but it's utterly wrong to say, because there are some risks, that every risk leads inexorably to massive escalation, much less that the West should therefore take no military action. There's ample distance between step alpha and step omega. Clearly, however, once again, Putin's getting much of what he wants from NATO for free. He threatens, he blusters, he uses the word nuclear, and the West wilts. It's the very paradigm of effective deterrence. There are undoubtedly hard and dangerous choices to be made, but totally military quiescence also imposes costs, strategic and humanitarian, which are now unfolding. Predictably, hesitant Westerners are fearful of giving Russia a pretext for attacking NATO members. If Moscow needs a pretext, it has one already. Washington has long and quite rightly provided intelligence to Ukraine at a frenetic pace. Further pretexts include the White House's boasting to favored media outlets about the massive provision of anti-tank weapons and cyber warfare assistance. Europe and America are indulging in considerable self-satisfaction about the economic sanctions deployed against Russia. But we should not feel serene that although our deterrence broke down and Ukraine is being devastated, Russia is suffering severe punishment. The purpose of deterrence strategy is to prevent the conflict entirely, and there Washington failed badly. Worse, Russia's prospects of prevailing against Ukraine are enhanced by its successful deterrence against NATO's acting in ways that could effectively counter its aggression. It is nothing to celebrate. How to End the War by Michael O'Hanlon. O'Hanlon holds the Philip H. Knight Chair in Defense and Strategy at the Brookings Institution. As tragic as things already are in Ukraine, they will likely get even worse in the days and weeks to come. Vladimir Putin deserves every bit of punishment this war may exact on him, on the battlefield, and on Russia's economy. But the people of Ukraine do not, nor do most of the Russian people. We should therefore not be content with a U.S. Western policy that simply imposes pain on Putin for pain's sake, since it may do little to mitigate the consequences of this conflict. The current sanctions should serve as part of a strategy that pursues the least bad possible outcome to this needless war. Although the war appears to be zero-sum in nature based on Putin's aims and the Ukrainian people's refusal to accept de facto Russian rule, there's one possible dimension where compromise may be possible, the idea of Ukraine's membership in NATO. That possibility was first promised by NATO at its summit in 2008, though no timetable nor interim security guarantee attended it. It was reaffirmed in the November 10, 2021 U.S.-Ukraine Charter that for all its good intentions and lofty rhetoric is beginning to look like a major mistake. The moral responsibility for this war is all Vladimir Putin's, but Western policy contributed to creating the strategic and psychological circumstances Putin then exploited. We need to rethink. The core of any possible deal would be to create a ceasefire and then the withdrawal from Ukraine of Russian forces, while foreclosing the possibility of future NATO membership for Ukraine, provided its security can be ensured by other means. These arrangements could be written into the Ukrainian Constitution and into an understanding that NATO reached with Moscow. President Volodymyr Zelensky would have to take the lead on proposing these terms, but the U.S. should encourage him. The reasons we can and should be flexible on the issue of Ukraine's NATO membership are threefold. First, Ukraine's joining NATO was never a good idea, given how incendiary that prospect is for many Russians, not just Putin, and therefore how counterproductive to the goal of stabilizing Europe. Second, it was not going to happen anytime soon, even before the Russian invasion, since there's never been a timetable for it. Third, it certainly is not possible now with Russian troops sitting on Ukrainian soil. But foregoing NATO membership is all that could possibly be asked of Ukraine. Otherwise, to make the deal acceptable, Russia would have to reaffirm Ukraine's sovereignty, return the Donbas region to Kyiv, accept monitors on Ukrainian soil, and acknowledge Ukraine could join any other organizations to which it was invited, including perhaps the EU. Crimea would have to be finessed, given its history and Russian sensibilities. Russia would also have to join us in guaranteeing the future security of Ukraine. Why would Moscow's promise be trustworthy this time? And why would Putin consider the terms proposed here? The difference would be that this time there would be no future prospect of Ukraine's joining the alliance that defeated the Soviet Union in the Cold War. With NATO membership no longer in the air, Russia could claim it had stabilized the security order of Eastern Europe in a way that was not possible in 1994. If Moscow subsequently violated its commitments, our promise not to consider future NATO membership for Ukraine would also dissolve. With this agreement, Putin would begin to get his economy back. Otherwise, he's poised to rule over a stagnant Russia for perhaps the rest of his days. Under this approach, as Russian troops withdrew, with monitoring on the ground by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the U.S. as well as allies would end their lethal military assistance shipments to the Ukrainian armed forces. As noted, some sanctions on Russia would also be suspended, then lifted. For those who would consider this policy too kind to Putin, that is understandable. He deserves no succor. But the peoples of Ukraine and even Russia should not suffer for Putin's sins any more than they already have. And this arrangement, like President John F. Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which he made minor concessions to get major payoffs, would rightly prioritize the peace as well as the security and sovereignty of Ukraine. The View Inbox, this is a short column, the Coronavirus Brief by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. The Atlantic's Ed Young recently wrote a piece marveling at our collective ability to accept the astronomical number of deaths associated with COVID-19. More than 967,000 in the U.S. and 6 million worldwide. As tragedy becomes routine, Young writes, excess deaths feel less excessive. Inured to COVID-19 deaths as we may now be, the actual toll is likely even higher than the official statistics show. A modeling study recently published in The Lancet estimates COVID-19 has caused three times as many deaths as the official global tally reflects, about 18.2 million in total. Not all these deaths were a direct result of the virus, but the indirect toll of the pandemic has been substantial. Hospitals have been overburdened with patients. People have been wary of seeking care out of fear of infection. Routine vaccination campaigns have slowed in many parts of the world, and isolation has prevented some people from getting treatment for addiction or mental health issues. All these factors likely contributed to higher than average death rates. The majority of these 18.2 million people would not have died but for the pandemic, one of the study's authors told my colleague Jeffrey Kluger. After 2 years of pandemic life, it is surprisingly easy to become numb to such shocking statements. But it is worth remembering that even as many people's personal risk levels drop because of vaccinations and past COVID-19 exposures, the virus continues to take lives around the world in all sorts of ways. The next column is Space Time by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. There's a thumbnail view of Jeffrey Kluger. Just a headshot, but above Jeffrey Kluger's little portrait is a dark and contrasting portrait of the dome of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, November 29, 2020. The sky behind the dome is black, except for a full moon rising. So it has the moon dogs, the corona around it, and it's large and circular and shining directly upon the Capitol, which brightens the gray granite texture of the dome. Space-time, on its face, 1966 was a good year to be a consumer. A gallon of milk would set you back just 42 cents. A gallon of gas, which today is topping $5 in some places, went for 31 cents. And what did it cost to finance the greatest space program in the history of the world? A space program that put boots on the moon in 1969? That cost taxpayers $5.93 billion in 1966, which represents the high water mark of NASA annual funding. Of course, inflation plays a role, too. That same 42-cent gallon of milk goes for $3.68 in 2022 dollars. NASA's $5.93 billion annual allowance, similarly, would translate to $51.66 billion this year. That generous funding's worth contemplating as Congress recently completed work on an omnibus spending bill that allows NASA $24 billion, or less than half of what the space agency was getting back in its golden era. The details of the spending bill reveal a lot about why it's been half a century since human beings last landed on the moon. In 2020, NASA requested $3.4 billion to build its Human Landing System, HLS, a 21st century lunar module to carry astronauts down to the surface of the moon from lunar orbit. Congress responded with a check for just $850 million. This year, NASA requested $1.195 billion and got it. That's good as far as it goes, but remains less than half of what's needed to build the ship for real. Then, too, there's the SLS, the 21st century's Saturn V moon rocket, which is budgeted at $2.6 billion for 2020, a funding level that allows for launching one rocket per year. Back in the Apollo days, 11 Saturn Vs were launched from 1968 to 1972. Similarly, the Orion spacecraft, the modern-day version of the Apollo orbiter, was budgeted at just over $1.4 billion this year. Orion has been in development in one form or another since 2004 and has never carried a crew. The government has its spending priorities, and if the decision has been made that space is a lower-tier enterprise than it was in 1966, fine. But please, no more promises of moon landings in 2024 or even 2025 or 2026 if you are not going to cut the checks to make the missions possible. You can either talk about going to the moon, or you can spend the money and go. The choice Washington is making is regrettably clear. The Westerners who helped fight for India's independence by Ramachandra Guha, that's G-U-H-A, and Guha is author of Rebels Against the Raj, Western Fighters for India's Freedom. For Western historians, the news of democratically minded volunteers from other countries enlisting to fight with the Ukrainians against their Russian invaders might bring to mind the creation of the International Brigades during the Spanish Civil War. But there may be some Asian resonances, too. I'm thinking in particular of the remarkable but sadly forgotten story of the British and American fighters for India's freedom. From the late 19th century onward, a series of exemplary individuals disavowed their citizenship of powerful white imperialist nations to live with and struggle alongside the subordinated peoples of the Indian subcontinent. In India itself, these rebels against the Raj are only dimly remembered, mostly through landmarks that carry their names. When back in 1995, two nativist parties came to power in the state of Maharashtra, one of their first acts was to rename the state capital, then known as Bombay, as Mumbai, and many other landmarks followed. Only a few among Bombay's great landmarks escaped this purge. They included a key arterial road through the heart of the city, which is still officially known as the Dr. Annie Besant Road, and a lovely shaded park opposite the gorgeous building built in the early 19th century that houses the Asiatic Society, known as the Horniman Circle. Even the nativists dared not tamper with these names, for they honored foreigners who had truly become Indian. Annie Besant is a name that might still be vaguely familiar to some historically minded readers of time. Three quarters Irish, a socialist and a suffragette in her British youth, she embraced in her 40s the then popular creed known as Theosophy and moved to India, where she helped establish girls' schools and a major university before becoming a leader of the Indian Home Rule movement. In 1970, Besant was chosen the first female president of the Indian National Congress. The Englishman B.G. Horniman remains unknown to most Indians, yet in his day he was a considerable figure. The editor of a major newspaper, the Bombay Chronicle, which strongly supported Gandhi and the freedom struggle. Horniman was a radical who campaigned for the rights of workers and peasants and also established the first trade union for journalists in India. People like Horniman and Besant complicate the popular narrative of nationalism, which features brave Indian men and women resisting racist and oppressive British men and women. Later this year, India will celebrate the 75th anniversary of its independence from colonial rule. There would have been much chest-thumping anyway, but now, under Prime Minister Narendra Modi, it will take on a hyper-nationalistic and even xenophobic tone, with much bragging about how Indians alone, and perhaps Hindus most especially, have enabled the past, present, and future glories of our country. It is here it behooves the historian to recall those exemplary foreigners who were renegades to their race, their nation, and even their religion. I have mentioned two rebels against the Raj, yet there were others, too, who were no less remarkable. Consider Madeline Slade, who worked with Gandhi before becoming a pioneering environmentalist. She was the daughter of a British admiral who came to India in 1925. Changing her name to Meera, she spent long periods in the jails of the Raj because of her identification with the freedom movement. The stories of these daring and at times reckless boundary crossers need to be better known in India and in other lands too. For the lives and doings of these individuals constitute a morality tale for the world we currently live in. This is a world governed by paranoia and nationalist xenophobia. With the rise of jingoism in country after country and a corresponding contempt for ideas and individuals that emanate from outside the borders of one's nation, Modi and the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh in India, Donald Trump and the white supremacists in America, Boris Johnson and the Brexiteers in England, Vladimir Putin and his revanchist regime in Russia, all see themselves as uniquely blessed by history and by God. No foreigner, they believe, can teach them anything. The stories of Besant, Horniman, and company tell us otherwise. From the movies page, A Maid's Day Off, A Life Unchanged by Stephanie Zakarik. In Eva Husson's Mothering Sunday, Jane, Odessa Young, a young housemaid in 1924 England, uses her day off for a secret assignation with Paul, Josh O'Connor, a toff from a neighboring estate who's engaged to be married to a class-appropriate beauty. Paul's house is empty. The servants are off visiting their mothers for the holiday. His parents are at a luncheon, and his brothers are dead, killed in the war. His heart is still heavy, and in bed with Jane, he finds respite from his melancholy. Though Jane loves him, their class differences do not make her needy or vulnerable. In one of the film's most remarkable scenes, she pads alone, naked and self-assured, through Paul's large, drafty house, examining paintings, furniture, the books in the library, before heading to the kitchen for some meat pie and a bottle of beer. She belches after a hearty swig of the latter. Mothering Sunday is set in a sorrowful period of British history, when so many were mourning their lost sons. Colin Firth and Olivia Colman play such a couple, buttoned up in their grief. The picture's a bit arty and decorous. It could do with fewer swimmy camera moves, but Young vests it with a fascinating flinty grace. Never a victim, Jane keeps moving toward what she wants, resilient even in the face of loss. Her life is one big exploration, too far-reaching even for the walls of a grand country manor. A Mob Story Told in Tones of Muted Flannel, also by Stephanie Zakarik. The pleasures of writer-director Graham Moore's intimate little crime thriller, The Outfit, sneak up on you with the same glissando shiver that you feel when you slip on a silk-lined coat. Much of the story unfolds between lines of dialogue, in furtive glances between characters, or in clever feats of magician-like misdirection. The movie star Mark Rylance as Leonard Burling, a skilled but humble English tailor, is adept at actorly sleight of hand, gradually revealing his character's secrets in slivers of dry, wicked wit. It is 1956 Chicago, where the Savile Row-trained Leonard now runs his own shop. making fine suits for a clientele heavy on high-ranking gangsters. Though Leonard allows his workspace to be used as a sort of message center for the mob, he keeps his head down and his nose clean, focusing mostly on turning out meticulously worked buttonholes or cutting through swaths of wool with his treasured shears. His loyal receptionist, Mabel Zoe Deutsch, a bright young woman who longs to see the world beyond her stifling city, may or may not be having a romance with junior mobster Richie, Dylan O'Brien. And wherever Richie goes, his ambitious and hot-headed sidekick Francis, Johnny Flynn, goes too, stirring up trouble with every step. At the center of this clever pinwheel of a story, Moore co-wrote the script with Jonathan McLean, is Rylance, whose economy of motion and emotion is a marvel. As he sits quietly and watchfully sewing a sleeve hem, you believe in every stitch. Rylance shows how Leonard's confidence in his work ripples through him like electricity, reaching right through his fingertips. At times, Rylance's Leonard has the eyes of an anxious terrier, wary and alert. His gaze softens when Mabel's around. She's a kind of surrogate daughter to him, a jewel worth protecting. Nearly all the action in the outfit takes place inside Leonard's shop, a cozy lair shot in muted flannel tones of gray and gold. But Rylance fills the space with subtle grandeur. Every movement, every breath, is made to measure. Can we ever go back to off the rack? Here is Time Off Television, Inside the Making of a Trilingual Epic by Andrew R. Chow, C-H-O-W. In 2017, when film and TV agent Teresa Kong Lo read Min Jin Lee's epic novel Pachinko, which tells the story of a poor Korean family through generations and across borders, she feared it did not stand a chance of receiving Hollywood's attention. "I thought it was an impossibility," she says. This was pre-Crazy Rich Asians, pre-Parasite, pre-Squid Game. We had never seen something like this in series form. 5 years later, March 25, the first season of Pachinko, for which Kong Lo serves as an executive producer, will arrive on Apple TV+. It means it has arrived, if it occurred March 25th, in a vastly different landscape. Television shows from around the world, including South Korea's Squid Game and Paris' Arsène Lupin and the U.S.-Mexico drama Narcos Mexico, have found rabid audiences on Netflix. These shows have proved that contrary to decades of conventional Hollywood wisdom, viewers are willing to read subtitles and eager to consume global stories centering people of color. While Pachinko could ride this larger wave of global representation to success, the show is still a precarious risk for Apple TV Plus and its filmmakers. It is a trilingual, big-budget period piece that hopes to attract audiences without superheroes, sex, or dramatic action sequences. Pachinko's ability to find viewers could have a ripple effect on whether similar concepts are greenlit for years to come. Right now, stories about diverse people are largely relegated to a certain budget level, says Kong Lo. Pachinko is at a first, and we do not want it to be an only. Pachinko is the second level by Lee, who's Korean-American and several decades ago became fascinated by the struggles of Korean immigrants in Japan in the 20th century. She wove together the story of one family across four generations through the Japanese colonization of Korea, the impact of the atomic bombs on Japan, and the westernization of Japanese life. The main character is Sunja, who's born in the early 1900s and stoically absorbs the suffering of everyone around her as she perseveres through one crisis after another. The novel, a 2017 National Book Award finalist, struck a chord, especially with many Asians and Asian Americans who saw echoes of their own familial histories in Lee's work. One of those readers was writer and showrunner Sue Hugh. Under the Dome, The Terror, who was given the book by Kong Lo in the hopes that she might want to spearhead the adaptation. When Hugh read Pachinko, she was bowled over. It was such a shock. They were my mother and grandmother, she says. It was so visceral, that feeling of finally someone had the bravery to put these people's stories to work. But Hugh was terrified of leading such an important project and had to be convinced by Kong Lo she was the right person for the job. I told her, if you don't take this on, it's going to take another 7 to 10 years for another Asian American writer to rise through the ranks to get where you are as a really high-level showrunner, Kong Lo recalls. And we need to tell the story now. There were many factors working against Kong Lo and Hugh as they began shopping the concept around to streaming services. Not only did the show need to have an all-Asian cast, it also needed to be told in three languages, Korean, Japanese, and English, as its characters migrated across the world. Asian histories told by Hollywood, excluding war stories like Letters from Iwo Jima or The Last Samurai, were few and far between. And the Pachinko team was requesting an enormous budget, on par with that of The Crown or Succession, in order to convey the book's epic scope. Kong Lo says while many mainstreamers were initially interested in the concept, especially enticed by the allure of courting Asian audiences, they balked at the price tag. They told her, "We would not do that for this show." Kong Lo says Apple and Netflix eventually offered what the creators were looking for, and the team decided to go with Apple, thanks in large part to the support of executive Michelle Lee, who is now the streamer's director of domestic programming. Apple was trying to position itself as a home for international series and prestige fare with shows like Dr. Brain, and Pachinko hit both targets. Having an executive like Lee was everything, Hugh says. She also comes from the immigrant experience and knows these characters inside out. After getting the project green-lit, adapting the 500-page novel was another challenge completely. For one, the author was initially involved but left the project for unspecified reasons. Although I did not write or create the series, I wish them well, Lee wrote in an email. And while the book unfolds chronologically at a methodical pace, similar to that of the film Boyhood, Hugh felt the adaptation needed to be rearranged and placed into dual time zones, one starting in the 1910s and the other starting in the 80s. The greatest thing about film and TV is playing with time, she says. All of a sudden, when we move things around, the show became a thesis statement of how do you have a conversation with the past? How do you, from the past's point of view, leave something indelible for the future? The restructuring led to the character elevation of Sun Jia's grandson Solomon, an ambitious young banker determined to prove himself at his American firm, even if it means betraying his roots. Hugh hopes Solomon resonates with a younger generation. I connect very strongly to Solomon and the feelings of both immense gratitude and burden from what your parents and grandparents sacrificed for you, she says. The show's cast features a mix of newcomers and superstars, Min-ha Kim making her television debut as teenage Sun Jia, stars opposite Lee Min-ho, who's one of South Korea's foremost idols. Hugh says that she did not receive any pressure from Apple to cast marquee Korean stars, and that even Lee, who had not had to audition for a role for 13 years because of his mega fame in his country, had to try out for the role of Han Su. "This challenging next step in my career is an unfamiliar working environment, set my heart aflutter a bit," he wrote in an email. I'm so thankful we're living in a time where this diversity and globalization is accepted. For the actor Soji Arai, who plays Sunja's son Mozasu, Pachinko offered a rare opportunity to showcase his own Zionichi, the term for ethnic Koreans living in Japan, heritage. Arai's grandparents immigrated to Japan at the same time Sunja did, and his parents were activists who fought against discrimination. Arai says it's still very rare for Japanese stories to feature Zionichi characters or for Zionichi celebrities to proudly showcase their ethnicity, which makes this role all the more special. I'm so happy because now people all over the world will know who Zionichi people are, maybe for the first time in history, he says. Arai and the rest of the cast are waiting to learn if they return to their roles. While Hugh wrote the show to last four seasons, the series has yet to be picked up by Apple beyond its first eight episodes. These days, it is not uncommon for ambitious shows to be canceled prematurely. HBO's fantasy epic Lovecraft Country, for example, was axed after just one season. Kong Lo recognizes there's more riding on Pachinko's success than her resume. Any project with this scale and scope needs to perform better because of the financial investment, she says. I am really hoping people watch and streamers take notice and say, oh, look, we could do a big epic with other stories about people of color. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.